Hello, I'm Chuck Weiss, and welcome to Close Encounters. Every week at this time, I'll act as your guide while together we explore the twin phenomena of UFOs and alien abduction. Last week, we learned how the modern UFO era started in June of 1947 when an amateur pilot, Kenneth Arnold, reported seeing nine flying saucers near Mount Rainier in Washington State. We learned that in 1952, a fleet of UFOs buzzed the nation's capital and the White House, resulting first in a serious study by the Air Force to understand the UFO phenomena while being candid with the public, and later, after the CIA took control, to publicly debunk the whole thing while secretly continuing to learn all that they could. We also learned that Project Blue Book's Special Report Number 14 was a comprehensive and scientific study of the data collected, which concluded that 22% of all UFO sightings were genuinely unexplainable, real UFOs. Tonight, we'll go back again to 1947 to investigate what has become known as the Roswell Incident. But first, here are some things that you should know.
Do you have a great idea for a product or service but don't know where to start? Are you looking to expand your current business? Women's Initiative of San Francisco began its business management training program for low-income, high-potential women in 1988. To attend a free orientation on how you can achieve your dream of starting your own business, or for more information, please contact 415-641-3460 or visit womensinitiative.org. This public service announcement is brought to you by your friends at Mutiny Radio.
Save our democracy. We must reverse Citizens United, restore our democracy, and save the Republic. Join the fight for free and fair elections in America. Wolf Pack is the pack to end all packs, and they're working for a constitutional amendment to get money and legalized bribery out of politics, but they need your help. Become a member, volunteer your time, and sign your petition at wolf-pack.com. Welcome back to Close Encounters. I'm your host, Chuck Weiss. Now, let's go back in time to Roswell, New Mexico, 1947. In early July 1947, an incident occurred in the desert just outside Roswell, New Mexico. Many people have heard of the Roswell UFO crash, but very few people know the details of the incident. On the evening of July 3, 1947, Dan Wilmont, a respected business owner, and his wife were sitting on their front porch when they saw a bright saucer-shaped object with glowing lights moving across the sky at 400 to 500 miles per hour. Mr. Wilmont estimated the UFO was about 20 to 25 feet across. The flying object appeared from the southeast and disappeared into the northwest. Later, Mr. Wilmont reported the unusual sighting to the Roswell Daily Record. Sometime during the first week in July, W.W. Mac Brazell, the foreman of the J.B. Foster Ranch, saddled up his horse and rode out to check on his herd of sheep after a night of intense thunderstorms with his son Floyd and a family friend, Loretta Proctor. Brazell said that as they rode along, he began to notice unusual pieces of what seemed to be metal debris scattered over a large area. Upon further inspection, he said, he saw a shallow trench several hundred feet long that had been gorged into the ground. Brazell said he was struck by the unusual properties of the debris, and after dragging large pieces of it into a shed, he took some of it over to show the rest of the Proctor family. Mrs. Proctor said she remembers Brazell showing up with the strange material. The Proctors told Brazell that he might be holding wreckage from an alien spacecraft, as there had been a number of UFO sightings reported throughout the country that summer, or it could be some kind of government project, and that he should report the incident to County Sheriff George Wilcox. A day or two later, Brazell drove into Roswell and reported the incident to Wilcox. Suspecting that the materials described by Brazil might be connected with military operations, Sheriff Wilcox notified Major Jesse Marcel, intelligence officer for the 509th Bomb Group stationed at Roswell Army Airfield. After receiving the call from Sheriff Wilcox, Major Marcel was ordered by Colonel William Blanchard, the 509th commanding officer, to investigate Brazil's report. Along with Captain Sheridan Cavatt, a senior agent of the Counterintelligence Corps, Marcel followed Brazil out to the ranch. After spending the night there on Monday morning, July 7th, Marcel took his first step into the debris field. He would remark later that something must have exploded above the ground and fell. As Brazil, Cavatt, and Marcel inspected the field, Marcel was able to determine which direction it came from and which direction it was going. It was in a pattern. You could tell where it started out and where it ended by how it thinned out, he said. According to Marcel, the debris was, quote, strewn over a wide area, I guess maybe 3/4 of a mile long and a few hundred feet wide, end quote. Amongst the metal, Marcel described I-beam-like structures that were 3/4 of an inch by 1/4 inch, none of them very long, that would neither bend nor break. Some of the I-beams had indecipherable characters along the length in two colors. Marcel also described the metal debris as the thickness of tinfoil that appeared to be indestructible. After gathering enough debris to fill his staff car, Marcel decided to stop by his house on the way back to the base so that he could show his family the unusual debris. I didn't know what we were picking up, he said. I still don't know what it was. It could not have been part of an aircraft, nor part of any kind of weather balloon or experimental balloon. I've seen rockets sent up at White Sands testing grounds. It definitely was not part of an aircraft, missile, or rocket. Under hypnosis, conducted by John Watkins in May of 1990, Marcel's son, Jesse Jr., remembers being awakened by his father that night and following him outside to carry in a large box filled with debris. Once inside, they emptied the contents onto the kitchen floor. Jesse Jr. also described the tinfoil and I-beams and recalled the writing on the I-beams as, quote, purple, strange, never saw anything like it, different geometric shapes and circles. Under hypnosis, he also produced detailed drawings of hieroglyphic-like symbols. He said the symbols were shiny purple and that they were small. He also confirmed that his father said it was a flying saucer. I asked him what a flying saucer is. I don't know what a flying saucer is. It's a ship, his father replied excitedly. In 1979, Jesse Marcel Sr. was interviewed regarding his role in the recovery of the wreckage. Marcel said, quote, it would not burn. The stuff weighs nothing. It's so thin. It isn't any thicker than the tinfoil in a pack of cigarettes. It wouldn't bend. We even tried making a dent in it with a 16-pound sledgehammer, and there was still no dent in it, end quote. Other military officers who had been stationed at Wright Field in Dayton, Ohio, where the wreckage was eventually taken, have confirmed Jesse Marcel's description of the debris. Marcel reported what he found to Colonel Blanchard, showing him pieces of the wreckage, none of which looked like anything the two men had ever seen. Now, the Ballard Funeral Home in Roswell had a contract at the time to provide ambulance and mortuary services for Roswell Army Airfield. Glenn Dennis, a young mortician who worked there, received several strange phone calls from the mortuary officer at the base. Dennis, who at that point knew nothing of the crash or recovery of wreckage, was asked about the availability of hermetically sealed caskets for small children and for his recommendations on how to preserve bodies that had been exposed to the elements for several days while avoiding contaminating the tissue. His curiosity aroused, Dennis drove to the base hospital that evening, where he saw large pieces of wreckage with strange engravings on one of them sticking out of the back of a military ambulance. He then entered the hospital and was visiting with a nurse he knew there when suddenly he was threatened by military police and forced to leave. This incident only made Dennis more curious about what was going on, so he arranged to meet with the nurse on the following day at a local coffee house. The nurse said that she had been in attendance during autopsies performed on, quote, several small non-human bodies, end quote. She then sketched a drawing of the aliens on a napkin, which Dennis kept. It was, however, the last time that Dennis would ever see her. When he tried to contact her again a few days later, he was told that she had been transferred to England. But subsequent searches revealed nothing more of her whereabouts, and she was never seen or heard from again. At 11 a.m. on July 8th, Lieutenant Walter Haunt, Air Force Public Information Officer, had just finished a press release that Colonel Blanchard had ordered him to write. It provided no details, but simply stated that the wreckage of a crashed flying disc had been recovered. He then gave copies to the two radio stations in town and to both of the local newspapers. An hour and a half later, the story was posted on the Associated Press wire, stating that, quote, "The Army Air Force here today announced a flying disc had been found." Lieutenant Robert Shirky reported that as calls began to pour into the base from all over the world, he watched as MPs loaded the wreckage onto a C-54 from the 1st Transport Unit. Researchers later determined that the debris was flown to Wright Field in Dayton, Ohio, later named Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. Blanchard had sent Marcel to Fort Worth Army Airfield, later named Carswell Air Force Base, to report to Brigadier Roger M. Ramey, commanding officer of the 8th Air Force. Marcel told Haunt years later that he had taken some of the debris into Ramey's office to show him what he had found. Ramey wanted to know the exact location of the debris field, so he and Marcel went to the map room down the hall. But when they returned, the wreckage that had been placed on the desk was gone, and a weather balloon was spread out on the floor. Major Charles A. Cashin then took the now famous photograph of Marcel with the weather balloon. The press was called in, and it was reported that Ramey recognized the remains as a part of a weather balloon. Brigadier General Thomas DuBois, Chief of Staff of the 8th Air Force, said, quote, "It was a cover story, the whole balloon part of it. That was the part of the story we were told to give to the public and news, and that was it." Later that afternoon, Haunt's original press release was rescinded, and an officer from the base retrieved all copies from the local radio stations and the two newspapers in town. The next day, July 9th, a second press release was issued, stating that the 509th Bomb Group had mistakenly identified a weather balloon as wreckage of a flying saucer. However, in their book, A History of UFO Crashes, researchers Don Schmidt and Kevin Randall say that they uncovered evidence that shows military radar had been tracking a UFO in the skies over southern New Mexico for four consecutive days, when on the night of July 4th, radar indicated the object had gone down about 30 to 40 miles northwest of Roswell. They also reported that William Woody, who lived east of Roswell, said he remembered being outside with his father on the night of July 4th when they saw a bright object plunge to the ground. When they later tried to locate the area of the crash, they were stopped by military personnel who ordered them to leave the area. Now, as reports went out that the crashed object was actually a weather balloon, cleanup crews were busily clearing the debris. Bud Payne, a rancher, was trying to round up a stray when he was spotted by the military and escorted off the Foster Ranch. Neighbor Walt Whitmore and broadcaster Judd Roberts were also turned away when they approached the debris field. Back in town, Whitmore and Leland Strickland saw their friend Mac Brazell being escorted to the Roswell Data Record by three military officers. They tried to get his attention, but Brazell ignored them, which the two men thought unusual for Mac, who normally was a very friendly and outgoing person. They took it as a sign that he was deeply concerned about something. Once inside the newspaper and in the presence of his military escort, he told a reporter there that he was changing his story. Brazell then claimed to have found the debris on June 14th, almost 3 weeks earlier than he initially reported. This also seemed strange to those who knew Brazell, as he was universally regarded as a truthful and honest person, not someone likely to give false testimony. The next day, an Associated Press story said that, quote, "Reports of flying saucers whizzing through the sky fell sharply today as the Army and Navy began a concerted campaign to stop the rumors," end quote. The story also reported that the Army Air Force headquarters in Washington had, quote, "delivered a blistering rebuke to officers at Roswell." The military has tried to convince news media from that day forward that the object found near Roswell, New Mexico, was nothing more than a weather balloon. Now, that's the story of the Roswell incident that most people know. But here's what most people don't know. There is now convincing evidence that a second flying disc crashed in western New Mexico only 2 days later. When we come back, we'll learn about the second Roswell incident. But first, listen to this nice man and his important message. Hi, I'm Chuck Weiss. If you're an old baby boomer like me, pain is probably something you've learned to live with by now. Yes, there are drugs on the market that help, but they come with side effects and shouldn't be used for extended periods of time. But fortunately, there is an effective natural pain reliever available in this state, medical cannabis. Let me tell you about Alta California Botanicals. They're a manufacturer of fine cannabis tinctures. Now you can take your medication in liquid form, much more discreet than pulling out a pipe and lighting up. Alta California Botanicals offers five different formulations, each one addressing a specific medical concern. There are two that are designed for pain, one to be swallowed, of course, and a new one for external use only. I'm going to have to try that one myself on my arthritic fingers. There's a tincture for stress and one for anxiety. They'll certainly keep you mellow. And there's even one for people who suffer from MS. The cannabis tinctures from Alta California Botanicals come in 1/2-ounce bottles. Each batch is laboratory tested and certified free of pesticides and mold. In other words, completely natural and unadulterated. Alta California Botanicals doesn't sell directly to the public, of course, but if you visit their website at Alta, A-L-T-A, CaliforniaBotanicals.com, and enter your zip code, they'll give you a list of dispensaries near you that keep their tinctures in stock. Now here's a tip for the holiday season. Keep a couple of extra bottles of the stress formula handy. It'll help maintain your cool amongst all that shopping madness. I'm Chuck Weiss for AltaCaliforniaBotanicals.com. And welcome back to Close Encounters. In 1992, Stanton Friedman and Don Beliner published their book Crash at Corona about the Roswell incident. In their research for the book, they came across evidence of a second UFO that crashed just days later about 200 miles west of Roswell in the plains of San Agustin. It was Vern Metalis and his wife Jean who first relayed the story to Stanton Friedman in 1978. Vern's close friend Grady Barnett, nicknamed Barney by his friends, had told him that while working for the U.S. Soil Conservation Service, he had come across, quote, a large metallic object, end quote, stuck into the ground and a group of people there looking at it. Barnett said that they were standing around looking at some dead bodies. He thought that there might be more people inside the object that he described as disc-shaped and looking like it was made of stainless steel. The machine, as he called it, had been split open either by the impact or by an explosion. Barney went on to describe the bodies to his friend Vern. They were human, but not human. They had round heads and no hair. Their eyes were oddly spaced and quite small, and their heads were larger in comparison to ours. They wore a one-piece uniform that was gray in color, but without any observable buttons, belts, or zippers. There were a number of bodies, and they all looked to be male in color. While the story that Vern Metalis had to tell was certainly intriguing, it was only hearsay, a recollection of a conversation with a friend that took place over 30 years earlier. It wasn't until 1990 that an actual eyewitness came forward to confirm that the story was true. In January of 1990, an episode of Unsolved Mysteries aired about the Roswell crash, which Stanton Friedman and Kenneth Randall had helped research. In response to that broadcast, a man named Gerald Anderson called the producer to say that he had additional information that might be of interest. Friedman and Randall interviewed Mr. Anderson, and Jerry told them how he and some of his family had stumbled onto a UFO crash site in early July of 1947. Jerry, his older brother Glenn, and his father, along with his uncle Ted and cousin Victor, were rock collecting along a dried-out riverbed called an arroyo when they came across the crashed saucer. Now, 33 years later, Jerry agreed to meet with Friedman and Randall at the original site, where Jerry excitedly recalled what he had seen as a 6-year-old boy. I'm going to quote extensively now from Mr. Anderson's recollections as printed in Crash at Corona. We came across the bend in the Yararo, and Victor said, "Hey, look at that! There's something over there." We were 200 to 300 feet away. What we saw was a silver object. A circular silver object stuck into the ground, kind of at an angle. It was jammed into the hillside. It seemed to me that there was more than one tree that had been knocked down. It was kind of propped up on one of the trees. Initially, I really didn't realize what everybody was hollering about. And then, when they said crash, and when I finally saw it, I realized what I was looking at, and then it crossed my mind that it was a dirigible, a blimp, that had crashed. I don't know why. I think it was airships I was familiar with, because back in that era, they were quite large and quite awesome. I kind of had a thing about blimps. We headed straight toward it, and there was one point when we got close to it, my dad told me to stay back. 50 to 60 feet, we were practically on top of it. There was a big gorge mark where it had cut a big furrow across the Yararo from another hill on the other side. It tore up a lot of sagebrush, and there were small fires smoldering here and there. That's when my brother said, "It's a goddamn spaceship! Them's Martians!" Then everybody was running around in circles. I didn't stay put. I think I was scared. I went over there with them. And then there were three of these crewmen laid out on the ground, under the edge of the thing, in a shaded area, and there was this one sitting upright. The ones that were laying on the ground, two of them weren't moving at all. They were just lying there. They looked like they had some sort of bandages on them. One of them had it over his arm. The one I touched had it around his midsection and partly over his shoulder. It appeared to be, as I think back on it now, the one that was still alive and moving had given first aid to the others, and the one next to him was breathing very erratically, and his chest was heaving in an unnatural way. He was obviously in distress, very badly so. The other two didn't move at all. The only one that really moved was the one that was sitting up, and it was obviously scared to death of us. It was scooting backwards against the underside of the saucer. It was obviously terrified of us. At first, the adults just kind of oohed and awed around. My cousin Victor, as usual, was into everything in everybody's way. My brother Glenn was looking over the saucer-shaped object. He pulled Victor off of it. Victor was up on the rim where the gash was, and he grabbed him by the legs and pulled him off and told him to stay out of there because he could cause it to explode. And then Glenn went up there and was hanging half in and half out of that gash in the side, and I was standing there watching him. And while I was doing this, Dad and Ted were trying to talk to it in Spanish, and it wasn't responding. When someone moved suddenly, it would recoil, put its hands up like it was afraid it was going to be hit. It seemed to be in pretty good shape. Its uniform was torn in a couple of spots. The others, they were obviously injured. Their uniforms were in pretty sad shape. They looked like they'd been in a hell of a fight. I didn't see anything that looked like blood, though. There was this kind of container, a metal box next to the one that was alive, that had some kind of bandage-like material in it and some other stuff in it. It may have been a first aid kit. The one whose chest was moving funny, the one leg didn't look quite right. It might have had a fracture. The others really didn't show any deformities or anything like that. I'm convinced that the one I touched, his eyes were open, staring blankly, was dead. It felt dead when I touched it. It was cold. In looking back now, I think it was probably rigor mortis because it was stiffening up by that time. The odd part about it is, I often wondered why the other one didn't cover him up. We cover up dead humans because I think we're afraid to look at dead things. I think it's funny it didn't cover its dead crew members like that, unless that doesn't mean anything to them. See, I thought they were dolls. I didn't think they were real, even though I'd seen this one moving and reacting. I remember putting my hand against the side of the saucer, and it was cold, almost like it was refrigerated. Being out there in the sun and being shiny, I probably expected it to be hot, but it wasn't. It was very cold, like it was wintertime and you were touching something metal. And the area right next to it was very cool, compared to the other areas around there. The area around the spaceship was blazingly hot. I remember the desert sun. It was unbelievably hot. When asked how close he was to the alien who apparently was uninjured, Jerry said, "I was as close as you are to me right now. What are we, about 3 feet apart? I didn't get as close as Dad and my uncle because they were kneeling, squatting down right next to it. At one point, my uncle reached out and touched it on the shoulder like he was trying to console it. At that point, it wasn't recoiling in fear anymore. I was very close to him when he did this, about 3 feet away. Was it aware of your presence? It looked around at all of us. It was like it was trying to watch everybody at once. I think that might be one of the reasons I picked up on it being afraid. It acted like a cat that was around kids. It just constantly watched everybody. It looked at me several times. It seemed very uneasy, even when it had calmed down to a certain degree." "Why did you go around behind the craft?" "Because Glenn was around there. I went around to see where my brother was. My brother was up on the edge of this thing, and he was looking inside that rip in the side. He cut himself on his side of his face or nicked himself, and I went around to that side when he came out, and I could see in there where he was at, because the saucer was tilted. The edge was tilted down and jammed in at that point. I could see directly into it and was looking through the outer hull and onto another bulkhead, and that bulkhead was shaped exactly like the outer hull." In other words, circular. Again quoting, "You could see through the rip, and you could see what looked like components. I don't know if they were electrical, electronic, propulsion, or what. They were all seemingly hooked together by these cables, clusters of thread-like material in the form of a cable. One of these was hanging out of the rip. There were several hundred strands per one of these clusters. They were wrapped. They blew in the wind like a horse's tail, except there were lights all over the ends of them. These lights were undulating. They were flashing. Some of them were bright. Some of them were very dim. Some of them were flashing. They looked like fire on the ends of these thread-like things that were waving in the breeze. And you could see others of these things went from some kind of a package of components to another kind of package, kind of like they were cables of some kind. And down the center between these things, they were all in neat little rows, was like scribbling. It was almost a pink color on sort of a brown wood-like background, like it was writing or symbols that explained what this thing was. You could see some other lights in there. These lights were usually associated with components. Some of these were going off and on. The light would go off over there, and the light over here would come on. It was like circuitry was still functioning. There were some that were amber, some green. Were they the same color as the lights on the threads that were hanging down? Some of that was really brilliant red, and some of it was like brilliant white, strobe light bright. The others were red. They were incredibly brilliant colors, and they were fading. Some of them would fade, they were really faint, and others were brilliant and really obvious. Some of them appeared to be fluctuating in intensity, getting real bright and then dim, then partially bright and then real bright and then dim again. I never did get up in that crack. Glenn said it was very cold. I knew that, as I had already touched that portion of the outer hull. As an aside, let me say that in 1997, Colonel Philip J. Corso, U.S. Army retired, published his book, The Day After Roswell. In it, he maintained that he was given materials from the crash site at Roswell, which he then distributed to American industry in the hope that the alien technology could be integrated into ours. The back engineering that was done supposedly produced the transistor and fiber optics. Mr. Anderson's description of those thread-like strands woven and wrapped into cables sounds very much like fiber optics. When asked how big the gash was in the saucer, Mr. Anderson replied, 8 to 10 feet from bottom to top. It went almost from the edge of the saucer to the top of the dome, and probably in width, 3 feet. It was an elliptically vertical gash, like a parenthesis. The widest part of it seemed to be toward the center. It looked like it had been pulled open and all the metal turned in, and it was very ripped and jagged. There was a real strong smell, too, like maybe rubbing alcohol or acetone or something like that. And this is what I think was prompting my dad to jump on my brother's back constantly about his cigarettes, because he was afraid he was going to blow the place up. Right after that, these people came up the Aurora toward us from the opposite direction from where we had come. There was a man and five of his students, three guys and two girls, college-age students. They were in their late teens and 20s. That man was later learned to be a professor, one Dr. Bushkirk and his five college students. They were camped near some cliff dwellings a few miles away, working on an archaeological dig. The night before, they had observed what they thought was a meteor crashing to Earth and decided in the morning to take a hike to check it out. Their reactions were very much like those of Jerry and his family. Again, I quote Mr. Anderson. First with, "I don't believe what I'm seeing," and then with shock when they realized these weren't dolls, that they were live, but nobody knew what they were. And here's this funny craft, and Glenn and them are still talking about men from Mars and stuff like that. And then another guy just shows up suddenly. I had went up the bank and was standing there by the trees right by the saucer on top of the rocks. And there was a guy with a pickup, and it was one of those old model pickups, and it had a whip antenna on it like a police car. He walked over there and got to talking with Dr. Bushkirk and Ted and my brother and my dad. And he said that he had seen it from out on the playa. He had apparently worked out there, and he acknowledged that he made maps or something like that. Now, it is assumed that this man was Barney Barnett. It was at this point that the military arrived. They threatened everyone there with jail, or worse, if they were to ever mention what they had seen to anyone, ever. Of course, the skeptics accused Mr. Anderson of making up his story. So in 1991, the Fund for UFO Research paid for a lie detector test. The test was conducted by Robert Riggs, a former policeman and polygraph examiner for over 10 years. Mr. Anderson passed the test and was judged to be completely truthful in the telling of his story. Although there are no other eyewitnesses to this second UFO crash who have come forward, the most convincing corroborative evidence comes from another of Jerry's cousins, who is now a Catholic nun. Jerry's story was said to be backed up by a journal kept by his Uncle Ted. A copy of that journal was sent directly to Stanton Friedman by Ted's daughter, with the following note. "With this mailing, I want no more involvement with this sorry scenario, nor does my mother. This family has been plagued by this incident for years, and it is far beyond time that it should stop. Why Gerald would wish to reopen this is completely beyond me. I suppose he has his reasons. My father was obsessed with this unearthly horror and kept several journals to prevent others from getting to them. Wreckage and debris from the crash, along with a larger journal, are buried out there. I pray each and every day that God will grant protection, not only to Gerald, but to all of you who are involved with this. If this can help you in your quest, then so be it. But you must at this point honor my desire to no longer be involved." Forensic examination of the journal showed that it was written after 1970. Gerald and his cousin, however, have already explained that several copies of the original journal were made to prevent it from being destroyed by the government. To date, all attempts to locate the buried wreckage and the larger journal have failed. We're going to take a break now, and when we come back, I'll tell you about another credible witness who has come forward to confirm a second UFO crash near Roswell, New Mexico.
Hello? Podcast operator, how may I help you?
I'm looking for this really cool podcast station.
There are a lot of really cool podcast stations. You're going to have to be a little bit more specific.
Well, I'm not sure what it's called anymore. I went through a lot of changes. First, it was Pirates.
Pirates?
And then there's a bunch of initials, PC something. I really didn't get it.
No, I don't see anything under Pirates or confusing initials. Could you tell me something more about the station?
Well, I had an amazing following.
Like a cult?
No, not like a cult, more like a collective.
Cult collective?
Whatever, bottom line. People listened, it was good.
Well, what made the station so good?
Well, for starters, there was 30 unique radio shows.
That sounds like a lot.
Because it is. They had local and world news programs, open mic poetry slams, live bands, comedy shows, local world music shows, Spanish language, Greek language, community organized, centered shows, even a show about 420.
Weed? There was a show about weed on this station?
Yeah. And get this! Half their DJs are women.
I like that. What kind of music did they play?
Everything, house, techno, hip-hop, garage, soul, world, new, old, uptown, downtown, underground, vinyl. It was really cool.
Well, I looked all through the database, and I could only find one podcast station that fits that very description.
Really? You found my station. Are there pirates or animals, a bunch of initials I won't remember? What the hell is the name of the station?
Mutiny Radio, it says here. Mutiny Radio.
Mutiny Radio? Mutiny Radio?
Yeah, Mutiny Radio.
Well, that's a good name.
You're listening to Mutiny Radio. Same great station, new great name.
Hello, and welcome back to Close Encounters. Now, as I said, there was another credible witness who has confirmed a second UFO crash. In an exclusive interview, retired Air Force Lieutenant Colonel Richard French told the Huffington Post that there were two UFOs that crashed near Roswell, New Mexico in early July of 1947. Quote, "There were actually two crashes at Roswell, which most people don't know. The first one was shot down by an experimental airplane that was flying out of White Sands, New Mexico, and it shot what was, effectively, an electronic pulse-type weapon that disabled and took away all the controls of the UFO, and that's why it crashed. When they hit it with that electronic pulse, bingo, there goes all their electronics, and consequently, the UFO was uncontrollable." End quote. French was a seasoned pilot who flew hundreds of combat missions in Korea and Southeast Asia, and also held several positions working for military intelligence, most notably Project Blue Book, as a debunker of UFO reports. It is his history of debunking UFOs that make his statements seem credible to many researchers. French said that he was told about the UFO shootdown by another military officer from White Sands Proving Grounds, an area in the New Mexico desert where the U.S. military tested their new weapons systems. He told French that a second UFO crash was near Roswell and only a few days after the first one. "It was within a few miles of where the original crash was," said French. "We think that the reason they were there at that time was to try and recover any survivors of the first crash. I'm referring to the people from outer space, the guys whose UFO it was." Now, the crash on the plains of San Augustine was about 200 miles west of Roswell, and while 200 miles may seem like a lot, it's really not when considering the speeds at which UFOs are known to travel. Also, this interesting fact. White Sands Proving Grounds is located about equal distance from both crash sites. So if Lieutenant Colonel French is correct, then the same weapon that brought down the first saucer could have brought down the second. Those saucers didn't crash because they can't fly in inclement weather. They were shot down by our military in the opening volleys of a one-sided space war. In a future podcast, I'll give details about our clandestine space program and our war against the visitors. I'll also reveal what I've come to learn through my own personal research as to the reason we started that war, and it's not what you may think. We're going to take one last break now so I can get a drink of water and you can hear this important message.
The National Lawyers Guild is dedicated to the need for basic change in the structure of our political and economic systems. They seek to unite lawyers, law students, legal workers, and jailhouse lawyers of America to function as an effective political and social force in the service of the people, to the end that human rights shall be regarded as more sacred than mere property interests. For more information about your legal rights, how to obtain legal assistance, or to donate, please contact the National Lawyers Guild at nlgsg.org. That's nlgsg.org. This public service announcement is brought to you by your friends at Mutiny Radio.
Close Encounters is produced at Mutiny Radio, located at 21st Street and Florida in San Francisco. Besides hosting a wide variety of podcasts each week, Mutiny Radio serves the community as a venue for a host of entertainment and educational programs. We also have a 40-seat performance space available for rent, as well as an art gallery that we offer free to local artists. So if you're a performer looking for a really cheap place to put on a show, or if you're an artist looking for free space to display your talents, give our station director Pam Benjamin a call at 760-716-3865. That's 760-716-3865. Well, that about wraps up our show for tonight. Check me out again next week when we'll talk about Hollywood's treatment of UFOs. Until then, live long and prosper.